Dobry. Good. So I'm hoping to that in Annie Nati Karana is Paul's firm, Bulgarski Dumi. Yeah? It's okay? Good. Great. Good. I wanted to start by thanking you guys, especially those that have worked so hard while I've been off on my sabbatical, having a break, filling in various points, and especially then to Tony and to Roy, who have worked their socks off. And I hope that you guys have really appreciated that and spotted that, because it has been a tremendous amount of work that they've done and taken on. So my special thanks to the two of them, and also to Chris and to Joan, because behind every good man is a good woman, and sometimes in front of every good man is a good woman. So thank you for your support for them and for everything that goes on in church as well. Sabbatical naturally is a time to reflect and do a lot of thinking. And so what I've got, well, I worked out, we've got 6 Sundays between now and the start of Advent, the start of December, okay? Just 6 Sundays. That's how close it is until Christmas really takes off now for another year. So I was thinking, well, what should I do? What should I teach? And I thought that what I would do is just share with you some of the things that I've been thinking about during that sabbatical period. Okay, these aren't in any particular order, but this week we're going to start with discipleship. Okay, thinking about what it means to be a disciple. So I've chosen a passage from Matthew chapter 17, which you will have, as ever, in the welcome sheet. Okay, and you'll see it comes from Matthew 17. I have chopped out a bit in the middle because I just want to focus on the things I want to kind of draw out today. So it's maybe not quite so much of an expository sermon as it might normally be. But here we go then. It's Matthew 17. Six days later, Jesus took Peter and the two brothers, James and John, and led them up a high mountain to be alone. As the men watched, Jesus' appearance was transformed, so his face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as light. Suddenly Moses and Elijah appeared and began talking with Jesus. Peter exclaims, "Lord, it's wonderful for us to be here. If you want, I'll make 3 shelters as memorials, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah." But even as he spoke, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and a voice from the cloud said, "This is my dearly loved son, who brings me great joy. Listen to him." The disciples were terrified and fell down on the ground. Then Jesus came over and touched them. "Get up," he said. "Don't be afraid." And when they looked up, Moses and Elijah were gone, and they saw only Jesus. And then verse 14. At the foot of a mountain, a large crowd was waiting for them. A man came and knelt before Jesus and said, "Lord, have mercy on my son. He has seizures and suffers terribly. He often falls into the fire or into water. So I brought him to your disciples, but they couldn't heal him." Jesus said, "You faithless and corrupt people, how long must I be with you? How long must I put up with you? Bring the boy here to me." And Jesus rebuked the demon in the boy, and it left him. From that moment, the boy was well. Afterwards, the disciples asked Jesus privately, "Why couldn't we cast out that demon?" "You don't have enough faith," Jesus told them. "I tell you the truth, if you have faith even as small as a mustard seed, you could say to this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it would move. Nothing would be impossible." So, one of the things that we kind of realised, is this up high enough? That's better. that I realised when I was on sabbatical was that I'm not really that fit and healthy. So Helen and I came up with a bit of a plan. We decided that we would start going swimming together. So we now try to go swimming together once a week down at the leisure centre. And the good news is that as we've done this, kind of we've both improved, which is great. Helen is a natural swimmer. You got your what? Your 3,000, 5,000 metre? 5,000 metre badge as a kid. Okay, 5Ks, that's what? Best part of 3 miles. Swimming badge. Fantastic. Me, I was always in that category at school they called non-swimmer. Which was odd because I did swim. It's not like I just went in the pool and sank. But I did swim, but they called you non-swimmer. Basically, I wasn't very good at it. I wasn't particularly proficient. I swam because I had to, not because I wanted to. I didn't really enjoy it. But I've got to say that, actually, I've quite enjoyed swimming these last few weeks that we've been doing this. And I think it is good. It's going to be good for my asthma as well. So all in all, pretty good. I said earlier on that being on sabbatical, it gives you a time to ask questions, to reflect. You ask questions of yourself. You ask questions of God. And one of the questions I found myself asking was, am I fit to pastor you? Am I still fit to do this? Am I up to this job still? Is it time I jacked it in? Went and did something else? So that question of being spiritually fit, that's quite an important question. For me as a pastor, yeah. But I would say also it's important for all of us. You know, are we spiritually fit? Spiritually fit and well and healthy and everything? How would you measure that? How would you know that? You know, when you go and see a doctor, they'll ask you questions like, are you exercising regularly? They'll measure your pulse, they'll measure your heart rate, they'll measure maybe your lung capacity. If, like me, you've got asthma, they'll do that. How do you measure how healthy your faith is? So the question is, well, how healthy is my relationship with Jesus? So I've chosen a part of the Bible here that I just want to use to do that. Okay, as I said earlier on, it's not maybe how I might normally approach preaching, because usually what I do is I start with the Bible passage and then decide what I want to say, not start with what I want to say and then try and find the Bible passage to fit in. That's not generally a very good approach to preaching. But anyway, so here we are. We're in this section in Matthew 17. And this first part, verses 1 to 8, we call the Transfiguration. It happens, you can see it starts with Jesus taking Peter and James and John up a mountain. Okay, traditionally, this mountain is this one here, Mount Tabor in Israel. The exact location isn't crucial though. If it was, Matthew would tell us, but he doesn't. So there are a few other possibilities, but it's up a mountain. The meaning of the word transfiguration is your appearance being transformed. So that's what we read in verse 2 there. The men watched, the disciples watched, and Jesus' appearance was transformed. What they see, as Roy was talking about earlier on, is that kind of the glory of God in Jesus, the Son of God. That's what they see, isn't it? All that white light and so on. And then they have also, in this vision, is that the right word to describe it? I don't know. They see Jesus joined by Moses and Elijah. I don't know if they had name badges on. I'd be surprised. I don't really know how they knew it was Moses and Elijah, because I don't think they'd met. But somehow these two, you would say dead guys, but they're very much alive, evidently. Moses and Elijah, they're there meeting with Jesus. Peter exclaims on seeing this, "Lord, it's wonderful for us to be here. Isn't it great? Isn't it wonderful being up that mountain with Jesus in that moment? Yes, it is. Isn't it? Absolutely amazing. No one else has seen this. No one else has an experience like this. Even Moses himself, as he goes up the mountain, what he sees is he's standing in fire and cloud and goodness knows what else. He doesn't see Jesus quite like this. And the funny thing about this whole story, actually, and this was something I picked up on from my commentary, is that it's written very much from the perspective of the disciples' experience. It's all about what the disciples see, what they go through. It's not really about exploring, you know, Jesus' glory or something like that. We get that description of that glory and then we move on to the disciples' reaction. So the whole story seems to be shaped around how actually this moment of Jesus' transfiguration is for the disciples' sake. It's for their sake. It's not for Jesus' sake. Jesus doesn't get anything out of this. You might say this would be completely normal for Jesus were he not incarnate, you know, for the last 30 years. That this would be entirely normal for Jesus. Because he would have been there in heaven. He would have been there with Moses and Elijah. So this is for their sake. And Peter goes on to write later on in one of his letters how up on that mountain they were eyewitnesses of Jesus' majesty. You can see that in 2 Peter 1. So there's this amazing moment. But Peter's exclamation, Peter's shouting out. Well, to me it's kind of classic Peter, actually. It's lumbering Peter. It's Peter blurting out, diving in, jumping in, just being Peter. There's this beautiful moment, here's Jesus in all his glory, here's Moses and Elijah. And Peter goes, oh Lord, oh it's so wonderful to be here. Oh, can I make you a tent? Yeah, and you and your mates, can I make you a tent? I mean, really, you ever meet people like that just ruin a really fantastic moment? But Matthew writes that even as he speaks, this bright cloud overshadows them. There's a voice that comes from the clouds saying, this is my dearly loved son who brings me great joy. Listen to him. Listen to him. You know, Peter, I spotted this just as I was looking through. At this point in Matthew's gospel, if you've got a Bible in front of me, you'll be able to see this. Peter again and again opens his mouth. He can't help himself. You know, there's that bit where Jesus says, who do people say I am? And Simon goes, you're the Messiah, you're the Son of the living God. And Jesus says, shh, keep it down. And then Jesus says, look, I'm going to go to Jerusalem, I'm going to suffer and die and rise again. And Peter says, no, you know, that's never going to happen to you. And up here on the mountain, you get this wonderful scene and Peter's going, can I build you a tent? And then in a moment, if they're going to get to this business with the temple tax at the end of chapter 17, you know, and someone comes up to Peter and says, doesn't your teacher pay the temple tax? And Peter goes, well, of course he does. And before he even gets inside the house, Jesus is asking him a question about it. With Peter opening his mouth again and again, I just love it. But here's the thing then. Here's God's voice, and God says, listen. Too much talking, Peter. Not enough listening. Listen. Don't shout out all the time. Listen. It's amazing how, with Jesus in all his glory and everything, the disciples kind of are full of joy and they're really happy and, oh, this is wonderful. The moment that cloud comes and they hear the voice of the Father, they are terrified and they fall down on the ground. But here's the beautiful ending to the story. You can imagine them kind of cowering. But Jesus comes over and touches them and says, get up. Don't be afraid. There's nothing to be afraid. It's really reassuring, isn't it? A reassuring touch, some reassuring words. And I was just thinking that perhaps this morning, in some way, you just need to hear those same words of reassurance. Get up. Get on with it. It's okay. Don't be afraid. Come on. I'm here. Jesus is here. Come on. This transfiguration is a kind of unique moment in the Gospels. There's nothing else quite like it. It's something really special. That moment where we see, where the disciples, these three, Peter, James and John, they have this vision of Jesus in all of his glory, as he has been from eternity. But this story of Jesus, you know, this is the same Jesus throughout the Gospels. This is the same Jesus who grew up as a carpenter's son, who maybe they knew from the neighbouring village. This is the same Jesus. This is the same Jesus who called them, who has walked with them miles and miles around Israel and Palestine, who has eaten with them, gone to parties with them, slept in the open air with them, whatever it is. This is the same Jesus that has been through all that with them. And this is the same Jesus, this Jesus in all his glory, all this splendor, all this majesty, all this power, who's going to be crucified, apparently in weakness, in agony, with great suffering. It's that same Jesus. It's not a different Jesus. It's not swapped out for another Jesus halfway through. It's the same Jesus. But he's also the same Jesus who's going to be raised to life, whose glory is ultimately going to prevail, who's going to be ascended and seated at the right hand of the Father. That same Jesus. That's the Jesus that we come across in the Transfiguration. It's quite fantastic, isn't it? It's the kind of story that just makes you, well, do that. Just be quiet. Be kind of on the edge of your seat, you know. You feel all the more Peter going, oh, can I build you a tent? In the midst of that silence, can't you? I love Peter. But then the next thing happens. And from the tops, you know, this from the peak, they go to the pits, you know. Here's the great and wonderful scene. Jesus in his glory, top of the mountain, bottom of the mountain. Ah, something's not quite right. Jesus and James and Peter and John, they arrive at a moment where the other nine disciples are, to be honest, in the midst of failure. The man tells the story. Here, Lord, I brought my son. He's like this. He has these seizures. I brought him to your disciples. They couldn't help him. They couldn't do anything. The boy's father had made this assumption. If I bring my son to the disciples of this man, Jesus of Nazareth, they will be able to help him because they're Jesus' followers. And they can't. Well, they don't. He's sick. We get the description of the seizures and, you know, all this. Later on, through what Jesus says, well, through the question they asked, actually, as well, that, you know, it's quite clear that this is not a natural sickness. There's something spiritual going on behind here. Jesus has to rebuke a demon from this lad. The disciples' question in verse 19 seems to indicate that they knew that. It wasn't as if they'd missed that and were, you know, trying to treat one thing when actually the problem was something else. They seemed to know that. But there's something wrong. So have a listen to Jesus' words then. What does he say? You faithless and corrupt people. That's quite shocking. I read this story, I read those words in July while I was off. And it really struck me. Because as soon as I read it, I thought, well, who is Jesus really talking to here? Is he blaming the Father in some way? Is he blaming, you know, the situation at the time that, however it happens, ends up with a little boy having a demon that gives him terrible seizures and whatever else? Is that what's going on? And actually, I came to this worrying realization that, of course, the story is a whole. And when Jesus says, you faithless and corrupt people in verse 17, he's talking about the same people he's talking about in verse 20 when he tells the disciples they've not got enough faith. Ouch. You know, we love it when Jesus is being beautiful up the top of the mountain. We love it when he's saying really wise sayings, doing this wonderful teaching. I tend to skip over the bits in the scriptures where Jesus says quite stinging things to people. Usually they tend to be the self-righteous teachers of the law, you know, that kind of people. Here Jesus is very much addressing his own disciples. Jesus isn't all nicey-nicey. He doesn't always say things that you want to hear. Sometimes he says things you don't want to hear. Jesus heals the boy. And the disciples come and ask Jesus privately. That word privately is the same kind of, well, it's the same phrase in Matthew's Greek as when Jesus led them up on a high mountain to be alone. It's a lonely place. It's just the disciples and Jesus. There's no one else. Very private. Jesus, why couldn't we cast that demon out? They're ashamed. They knew they should have been able to do that. Jesus had sent them out already with his authority to go and cast out demons and heal the sick. They should have been able to do this. Maybe they had already done it with other people. What's gone wrong here? And Jesus just puts it like this. He says, well, you don't have enough faith. If you had faith like a mustard seed, you could say to this mountain, the mountain he's just come down, move, go and shift over there, move. And it would be, nothing would be impossible for you. Here's a mustard seed. Can you see it there? Can you see a mustard seed in the hand? Jesus says, you only need faith that small to move a mountain. How does that work? Haven't they got faith? Haven't I got faith? Am I so full of doubt that my own faith isn't even that big? Is that the problem? Because I tell you what, I wouldn't say to a mountain, move, and expect it to do so for no apparent, you know, just because I can. Would you? Would you do that? Hands up anyone who's ever tried. No, I assume then that you wouldn't do it either. This is one of Jesus' hardest sayings, because I don't totally get it, and I'll be honest with you about that. But it works something like this, that it's not about the size. The size is not the issue. Because even if your faith's only as small as a mustard seed, you can still do extraordinary things. That's the point of what Jesus is saying. So it's not about our faith. It's not about our faith. There's another time Jesus talks about mustard seeds, about how a man's planted deliberately a mustard seed in a field, and it grows, and he says, this is like the kingdom of God, and it grows, and it's so big that birds can sit in it, it's big and strong and everything like that. There's a sense in which the power is in the seed. You know, it's not to do with the size of the seed. It's to do with the fact that you're close to Jesus. It's faith in Jesus. That's where the power comes from. Jesus only needs that much space, and he can do extraordinary things. You don't need a big faith. It's not to do with our faith and how, you know, how great we are. It's to do with Jesus and how great he is. And that's why even a tiny faith, a mustard seed-sized faith, can move mountains. Because in the end, it's not to do with us, it's to do with the fact that Jesus can do anything he likes, because he's this glorious Son of God. Can I tell you something encouraging now? Not only was it the same Jesus up the mountain, it's the same disciples here who are going to go on into Acts. They're the same disciples whom Jesus, after the resurrection, after they've scattered at the cross, Jesus brings them back together and says, hey, I still love you. You're still my apostles. He has that wonderful exchange. Remember that wonderful exchange on the beach where Peter jumps out of the boat to swim to shore to get to Jesus? They have breakfast together, and then Jesus says, Simon, do you love me? You know? That wonderful reaffirmation of Peter. And I'm sure it goes for the other disciples as well. Because they're the same disciples who are going to be there 50 days later at Pentecost when the Holy Spirit comes down upon them. That God pours out his Spirit on to do extraordinary things through them. To grow the church. They're the same disciples who are going to be described later on as turning the whole world upside down. They're going to do such dramatic and wonderful things for Jesus. Isn't that great? They're the same disciples that he calls faithless and corrupt and says, you don't even have faith as big as a mustard seed, are those people. That's wonderful. So what does it tell us about discipleship? I've said before, I like this series called Band of Brothers. I've got it on DVD. I lent the set to Lynn one time. Don't know if she enjoyed it as much as I did. I started watching this again while I was on my sabbatical because I love it and I had the time. And there's this moment on D-Day where they've just landed, well, they've just jumped from the aeroplanes. There's flak going off everywhere, and the pilots just, because one of them gets hit, they just press the button, and there's men jumping out of planes in all the wrong places. None of them are in the right drop zones. They're carrying so much gear, it's amazing they don't just fall straight to the ground. The parachutes actually keep them floating down. But this guy on the right, he's the lieutenant at the time, okay? And this guy on the left, you can't quite see. This guy belongs to a completely different unit. He knows him from playing basketball. He's the basketball coach, and he's in the basketball team. Anyway, he lands, and they meet up pretty much straight away. They don't fall very far apart. And the private says, I've lost my radio. And he uses this phrase, I'm sure I'm going to get chewed up for that. And then the lieutenant, he says these words. He says, I'd say you're a rifleman first and a radio man second. He's an infantry soldier. His job, actually, is to engage the enemy. Yeah, he had a radio. Perhaps he's supposed to use the radio in battle. But as far as this lieutenant's concerned, here's the reassurance for this guy at that moment. You're a rifleman first, radio man second. Okay? What's that got to do with anything? The point for me was this. I'm a disciple first and I'm a pastor second. There's no point trying to do the pastoring bit if I don't get the discipling bit right. If I'm not a very good disciple, you won't get a very good pastor. See what I mean about spiritually fit? So I need to make sure that stuff is right between me and God. I need to care for that. I need to look after that. Because if I don't, you guys don't get a very good pastor. You guys get somebody who is strung out. Someone who struggles to love you. Someone who is very tired. Someone who would rather be anywhere else doing anything else than this. So I need to make sure I'm a disciple first. Here's the things I need to remember then. Firstly, that Jesus is the Lord of glory. He's the guy on the top of the mountain. He's beautiful and wonderful and awesome. I need to listen to him, not listen to my ego. Here's Peter saying, Lord, I could do all this for you. Look, I could build you these tents and these shelters up the top of this mountain. It's so wonderful for us to be here. And the voice of God comes and just says, no, listen. Listen to Jesus. That's what you need to do. Just listen to Jesus. So I need to make sure I'm listening to Jesus. Get that wonderful statement, not just listen to Jesus, but also the Father saying, this is my Son whom I love, he brings me great joy. Is Jesus my joy? Or is following Jesus and pastoring you guys a pain in the bum and I'd just, you know, be much happier if I could do something else? Is Jesus my joy? I need to make sure he is my joy. Is Jesus your joy? Because whatever job you do, if you're working age, right? Whatever role you play in church, whatever else it is out there in the big wide world as well, before all those things, you have to be a disciple. That has to undergird everything. That has to be more important than everything. If you're so stressed out or something, or so got something going on in your head which is so big that you can't be a disciple, don't try and do other stuff in church life, please. Just take a break. It's okay. Let someone else pick up the reins for a while. That's okay. Look after yourself as a disciple. Make sure Jesus is your joy, not your burden. Here's the second thing. It comes, really, doesn't it, out of that story with the failed healing by the disciples, that somehow without Jesus, ministry loses power. What exactly had gone wrong there, I don't know. But if this business with the mustard seed and the faith is that somehow the disciples had lost faith in Jesus and thought they could just go out and heal somebody because they could, it's gone wrong. I don't want my ministry here to lack power because I don't spend time with Jesus. Because I'm not a very good disciple. I don't want that. I want to love you guys and I want to be able to minister in power to you guys and to the neighborhood around. That's not going to happen if I don't spend time with Jesus. If I don't bring him into what's going on. So I've got to have mustard seed faith. I've asked this question, have we got something twisted? Because that's actually what that word corrupt in there means. It means twisted. Get something upside down and round the wrong way. Doesn't help. Lastly, discipleship's an investment of time. Jesus said to Peter, James and John, come up this mountain with me Must have taken time to climb up there. While they were there, all this stuff happens. How long, over what period, I don't know. I don't know how long that lasted for. But Jesus regularly takes time to be alone. We read that in the Gospels. He regularly tries very often, to draw his disciples aside to spend time with them alone because he knows that they need it. Very often there's crowds running along the shore that get in the way and get to where they're going before they kind of arrive and so on. But there's that investment of time. It does take time. If your discipleship consists of hastily reading a kind of thought for the day over your cereal, and that being the last that you think of Jesus all day, probably that's not enough time investment, really, to have a good relationship with Jesus. For those of you that do read that way, that's absolutely fine, provided you're spending the time. If you're in a hurry to get out the door and get on to the next thing, it's not going to do anything for you. So I need to rest with Jesus. I need to listen to Jesus. I need to worship Jesus. I need to talk to Jesus. I need to reflect on things with Jesus. That's what I need to do. Are you too busy to slow down? Last story. Taking time, it does take time. I said earlier on, I'd started going swimming. A couple of weeks ago, I went to visit a friend in Hungary, or a couple of friends in Hungary, one of them I lived with when I was at university. Now, strangely, 16, 17 years ago. Hard to believe. Anyway, and he said, before I went out, he said, "Do you want to go to a spa?" I thought, what? When do I ever go to a spa? You know, what happens at spas? You get people that, it costs vast amount of money for people to do things that really don't achieve a great deal. And, you know, anyway, Hungary spas were a little bit different. Spas look like this. Okay, that's a big bath. That's thermal water, thermally heated by the ground, that is, you know, geothermal heated water with, you know, natural minerals in it and all the rest of it. Okay, we got there at 10 to 10 at night. We spent the next hour there. Fantastic, right? That's one of about a dozen pools of different shapes, some different temperatures. There's some cold ones, most are warm, kind of bath temperature, very nice. And you just go there and you spend time sitting there. You can't quite see, but here in the middle, right, these two sets of chairs opposite, they're chess boards. You can sit there and play chess in the middle of your spa. That's what you do. This is a Hungarian-type thing to do. It's not cheap in Hungarian terms. Hungarian income is less than half the average of what the UK average income is. All right, but that cost us £3 to go there in the night. £3, right? We spent an hour there, and it was just really nice. A little bit awkward occasionally, because there were some canoodling couples. But there were families, there were guys. It's just what you did. You went there. And we spent an hour there chatting, talking about spiritual things, relaxing together. That's very different, isn't it, to this idea of what it means to be fit. Then swimming up and down the pool as fast as I can. How many laps can I do today? Well, more than Helen. you know, in Britain we're very much like, yes, gotta go for it. Hungary's like, no, just chill out, relax in your spa, that's okay, rest. And sometimes that's what we need to do with Jesus. Instead of being all busyness, we need to rest, relax, spend time with him. It's relational, okay? It's about relationship. Anyway, that's the kind of image. So it's just something to do with that, okay? I think that's the end of my... Yeah, there we go. I've talked for too long. Let's pray together, shall we? Lord Jesus, thank you call us to be disciples. Thank you that we're your disciples. And you love...